So hi everyone, and welcome to this week Quantum Gravity Seminar. That is also the last week, last seminar for this year. And so today we have Luca Ciambello, who is a postdoc and is based in Brussels at the ULB. And today he will talk about a new perspective on quantum gravity. As usual, if you want to ask a question, just raise your hand on Zoom, or you can ask anonymous questions using the Google form in the chat. And Luca, you can start whenever you're ready.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm ready. Thank you, Alessia, for the organization, and thank to all of you of the Quantum Gravity Group for having me here. It is a pleasure to talk about hopefully some new perspectives on an old topic. So I've been asked to talk also about one of my recent papers, but I've tried to make a more comprehensive and large story, and I will try to guide you through the ideas that brought us there. So let me start. And as I told you, I will take the problem from far away. And as far away as to go saying things that are obvious to use, but we will go into details. Of course, we all know that gravity, and in particular, the quantization of gravitational theories is still a very much open and deep question. And we all know also that if we try to approach the problem at face value, meaning with tools that are at our disposal that have been in the past, many of these attempts are unsuccessful for reasons that we actually understand. And some of the things that I would like to point out is that a lot of classical physics and intuition permeates our understanding of gravity. And so when we think about gravity as a quantum theory and its classical limit as what it is, a limit, it's very difficult to understand what survives, what is there present in the quantum version of the theory. So for instance, in action, we don't expect to have a particular preferred dynamics. And as you, a perimeter, know well, even a classical notion of space-time may be something emergent, so emergent in the classical limit. So when we think about quantum gravity, there are really basic questions that we should address. And one of the big issues is that not having a quantum gravity theory at our disposal is not so simple to disentangle really what is classical from what is quantum and come from a quantum complete version of the gravitational theory. And so, as I point out here, we actually don't have many guidelines, and our intuition is unfortunately most of the time classical. And an example, which has been an historical discussion that has some turned out recently, is that we know we don't expect global symmetries to survive through our quantization. And this is, it's an old discussion, a 40 years old discussion, but recently has been also applied in the context of ADS-CFT. And on the other hand, we expect local symmetries to survive, probably modulo quantum anomalies. So it's actually my focus on gravity has been on local symmetries. And we expect local symmetries to tell us something deep about the quantum theory. And this actually, in my perspective, it's a key to understand a bit more about the quantum realm of gravity. And I will explain that in the detail later on. Let me start by pointing out that since the more than 100 year ago work of Emmy Noether, we know that local symmetries have actually support on codimension two surfaces rather than codimension one, like global symmetries. And in the Hamiltonian formulation, this has been beautifully explained by Regge and Teitelbaum in 74. It has been the core of the covariant phase space formulation of Iyer and Wald, and later on Anderson construction of Barnich and Brandt. And these codimension two surfaces in recent years, in the last 5 years, have been referred to as corners. And they actually became the focus of a new proposal which is called the corner proposal. It's new in some ideas and spirit, but is actually, in my opinion, going back to old ideas and try to refresh them with a new light and a new perspective. And well, as you may know, and I guess some of these colleagues are here in the audience, it is something that has been developed greatly at Perimeter Institute. So you are expert on the topic, and I will try to, for the non-expert one, give you a flavor of the ideas. And if I can summarize in a sort of punchline what the corner proposal is a way to understand that quantum observables actually organize according to algebras at corners. I will be more precise, but as a punchline phrase, I would say that the understanding of local symmetries and their algebras around the surface on which they have support, the charges associated, organizes how quantum observables transform. And this is actually, therefore, crucial to try to go back to disentangle classical notions from quantum notions and try to obtain something that is universal. If we have any insight of a universal algebra of these symmetries around corners, we expect this algebra to organize the quantum observables because it has not been derived assuming classical notions. This is essentially what a lot of people have been working on in the recent years. And my perspective, my angle to approach the problem has always been based on geometry. And with Rob Lee, we this year proposed a derivation of one algebra. It's important that it's one and it's not 300 algebras, otherwise it would have been a bit complicated to single out a universal feature. One algebra at corner that goes in line with the previous derivation, but that has been derived completely off shell and completely independent of any metric on the spacetime, assuming any pseudo-Riemannian or Riemannian structure on the spacetime. We expect this to be important for the quantum theory, but then we also, starting from this perspective, went back to more classical analysis. And very recently, again with Rob and the student of Rob Fin Chan, we have included these geometric tools that we found out in this analysis to generalize or to announce the canonical classical phase space of gravity with interesting repercussions that I will discuss later on. And this geometric point of view on corners actually has been far-reaching for us. And there is actually a connection, which I am currently exploring with Monica and Jacob, to celestial holography and recent appearances of algebras like W1 plus infinity algebras for the celestial holography proposal. And the celestial holography proposal and the corner proposal, in my opinion, are at a very similar footing because they both, the sentence that we want quantum observable to organize accordingly into some algebras that we find classically, quote unquote, but without classical assumptions, so that could survive quantumly, is both at the base of the corner proposal and the celestial holography, I would say. All right, so with this in mind, my talk would start reviewing corners, and I will derive the algebra, the one algebra that we expect to survive in quantum gravity, and we will later go more to classical aspects and discuss what we recently have done with the classical phase space. And hopefully, time permitting, I will conclude with some future perspective and a more general overview of what we are heading toward, hopefully. Okay, so let me start. To discuss the geometry of corner, again, I will try to use less and less classical features from the beginning and then go more and more classical. So less and less general or universal, if you want. So the only thing that I will start with is the presence of a manifold, in d dimensions, and I will introduce for the moment another manifold completely independent, which has d minus k dimension. Right, so the idea of introducing this manifold is that if we link S and M and we take K to be 2, this is a D minus 2 dimensional manifold. So it is a corner in the language of the corner proposal. Okay, given these two manifolds, one general thing I can do preparing the link between S and M is to split the tangent bundle of the big manifold M into two subbundles, the vertical and the horizontal subbundle. It will be clear why I call them so, with rank d minus k and k. Then a practical way to introduce a horizontal subbundle is to say that it is the kernel of k, this index is a k-dimensional index, one forms n. Meaning simply that for any vector field on TM, it's NA annihilates them. And let me introduce local coordinates. So capital M index will be an index in the d-dimensional manifold M that splits in the UA k-dimensional index and XI d minus k-dimensional index, which is useful to discuss later on the presence of this manifold S. And in general, I can parameterize an A in this way. This is a general parameterization, where the idea is that if I had a foliation far away from the surface I will be interested in later on, this would be just this piece over here. But I actually parameterize with the connection, with the shift, the most general K1 forms I can introduce. And therefore, I can solve immediately for H, and I obtain that H is the span of this non-coordinatized vector. So it would be coordinatized in the absence of the shift. But in general, I'm not requiring it to be adapted to any coordinate system. And indeed, one can see geometrically A as an Ehrensmann connection. Why it is an Ehrensmann connection? Actually, you can think of it in analogy with even with more simple discussions that you might that you know well, like electromagnetism, in which you have a non-coordinatized vector, and you think of it as H, the horizontal subbundle, non-integrable, simply because when you take the commutator between these two bases, you just get something of the form Fija partial A, which is different than zero. This tells you that when you move in this plaquette, you're not integrable into this into a full hypersurface. Okay, so this A is mathematically called an Ehrensmann connection, and it plays a role right around for us. Okay, for the moment, I haven't linked S with M, and this is the important feature in the next slide, is that an embedding, which is a crucial object in the following for us, an embedding is a map from this manifold S to the manifold M. And a way to think about it in local coordinates is just it gives you, send the coordinate in S to how they look into the manifold M. Okay, and as I was saying, this is very important. And now comes the link with the previous slide, is that we can adapt the embedding to the split of the coordinates we made. And then defining the pullback of the embedding, which is just a map from T star M to T star S, is a map that takes forms in M and its form in M. Then the condition of the embedding is that if we want V to be the vertical, then its dual puts back to zero by construction, and the horizontal just puts back to forms on S. And an example that is very useful and that we will use is the trivial embedding, and is the thing that we're used to, is when you sit in a big manifold at some locus of point for which some coordinates are zero, and then you adapt the other coordinates to be the coordinates in the departing space. Okay, this is very useful, we will use it, but it is important in the following, especially in the canonical phase space analysis, to consider more general embeddings. So it's important to keep in mind that there are more general geometrical constructions. Okay, now we are ready to discuss a little bit more local symmetries. And in mind, we have diffeomorphisms for gravitational theories. So what we do is we just introduce some vector fields. and we split in the basis that we have chosen, and expand toward UA equals zero. Why toward UA equals zero? Because in this particular construction, I want to use the trivial embedding for which the UA are the normal coordinates and they just go to zero. Okay, and by expanding in powers of U, I just mean do something simple, construct build up for both components, the U towers. And these UA are K dimensional, so there are different directions. For instance, if you think of U as Z, the holographic coordinate in a DSFT, this would be just a sort of reconstruction from the boundary. That's the idea, generalization of that idea, if you want. And it's a big important question whether you can expand to all over orders, but we will not need it. And then what I do is I take the Lie bracket between two vectors of this form. Okay, and again, as you all know very well, the Lie brackets are metric independent, so I'm not introducing any structure, I just have M and TM. And I ask myself, if I turn on certain orders here, like these orders, for instance, do I get the same orders in the Lie bracket, or do I turn on some other orders? And the idea is that I'm looking for a sort of closure of this Lie bracket. So I want that if only certain independent generators in the U expansion are turned on, then the bracket will just close on themselves, will not generate other powers of U. This is what I'm interested in. And the question actually has a very simple answer. And the answer is either you go to all the expansion all the way to infinity in powers of U, which is, for instance, something that we're familiar with when we take some current algebras, or actually the only maximal expansion you can consider is of this form, namely on the horizontal, on the horizontal space, you would just have one power, no powers of U, and on the normal, you have one powers of zero and one. Okay, and this is the most general thing. You can show that whatever you turn on, if you turn on a U to the 72 power and you take the algebra, this will automatically turn on other terms that are not there. So this is the biggest that close on himself. This is what we define in April, the maximal embedded algebra. And as we will show in, I will show in a couple of slides, it has a lot of subalgebras that are very familiar to us. We expect this algebra from the logic of the introduction to be sort of universal. It's universal because I haven't introduced a metric. It's universal because I haven't introduced a dynamics. And also I haven't introduced, being metric independent, any gauge choice or follow-up choice, et cetera, et cetera. I have very few assumptions, and we derive this algebra here. Now, I didn't show this to you, but it has a precise form of a double semidirect product simply by staring at the way how X1 acts on X2 when you compute it explicitly. This is the structure that you get. Okay? So let's see some cases. If we consider K equal to 1, we're talking about essentially hypersurfaces. Hess is a hypersurface for K equal to 1. And the structure that you get is something of the sort of defense semidirect R, both semidirect on another R, because GL 1R just collapses to R. And there are a few cases that are known. One case is considering a DS holography in which we include also Weyl symmetry explicitly. We work on something like that from the geometric point of view with Rob in 2019, but actually I've done also another work a year later in which I compute explicitly also Noether charges associated to this algebra with Francesco, Glenn, Pujan, and Roman. Another case which is well known is a generalized BMS, extended BMS, and BMS itself. Generalized, extended, and BMS being completely arbitrary defense, not globally well-defined conformal killings, and globally well-defined conformal killings. And all these are a subgroup of this defense semidirect R structure, which has been extensively discussed. And also, it's very important to mention the work of Shaheen, Selin, and collaborators that studied general null boundaries in two and three dimensions and found an algebra compatible with this, again, included in the K equal one subalgebra of this. Now, let's go to K equal two, where really we are talking about corners now. because we are co-dimension two. And something that has been done in a collaboration in perimeter was obtaining an extension, a further extension of BMS that has been called BMSW, which is a BMS algebra supplemented with the Weyl generator, which is this parameter here. And it is actually a contraction of what also these people with some other people have done in recent years, which is the extended corner symmetry. Now, the extended corner symmetry is the closest that we can have to this for k equal 2, where the only difference is the GL2 singlet. And we will see indeed that dynamically the GL2 singlet decouples for Einstein. Okay, so this is very similar to this. It's been introduced, I think, clearly and discussed by Will and Loran in 2016. And since then, it has received a lot of attention. And if you want, the contraction to R equal infinity has been shown to give this algebra, which is again included here. And finally, stay tuned. Hopefully soon with Monica and Jakob, we will also create a more direct link of this maximal embedded algebra with the W1 plus infinity algebra that has resurfaced now in the analysis of celestial holography. Okay, so now that we have this vector fields algebra, we ask ourselves, let's go more classical. Let's introduce something more. Let's define a metric, let's define a dynamics, let's compute some charges and see how far we can go with this. We expect this algebra to be universal, so we feel free to expand all the way to the classical limit, quote unquote. The first thing to do is to introduce a metric, and clearly a very natural metric for the discussion we just had is a metric that has this parametrization. It's fully general, it's a choice of parametrization only, such that HAB single out a metric on the normal fibers, the NA are the span of V, and the gamma IJ just pulls back to a metric on the corner S. Okay, now introducing this metric, we can do the same game that we did for the vector fields Xi above. We just expand everything in powers of U. We are again assuming the trivial embedding. So it's located at U equals zero and the axis coordinate are identified with the intrinsic sigma coordinates. We assume here, importantly, a finite distance corner to do so, because we assume that the metric expands in finite powers of U. It doesn't have a Loran poles in U. And we compute just how a diffeomorphism acts on this metric via just simply the Lie derivative. What we obtain is very talkative, actually, is essentially that all this data inside here transforms in representations, actually, at leading orders of this algebra. There are some leading orders that have more general structures. And in particular, let me just actually show all the slide, because I think it's a little bit dense, this slide, but I think it's very important. In particular, let's just give some color. So in all it, we have what we will be identified with DFS. And the DFS talks with the IJ indices. So this HAB contains no IJ indices, and indeed it transforms as a scalar under DFS. This AI are the components of a one form, transformed like the Lie derivative of the components of a one form, same for A1, and gamma zero is a rank 0-2 tensor with respect to DFS, and this is exactly what is shown here. It's very natural that by construction, everything organized such that these things happen. In blue is the GL2R. These are just matrix multiplication and rotation of the AB indices. That's exactly what happens here, there, and there. And interestingly, if we think about it, the translations do what we expect translations to do. These are translations because these are the object of the form Xi A of X partial A. Okay, so they don't have powers of U, they're not conformal in U, they're leading orders in U. And what they do, they really translate. They translate zero in the U expansion to one. They translate, for instance, this one to a two here. They couple to the next order in the expansion in U, which is exactly what we expect the translation to do. There is something else though. There are these red terms. And these red terms, as you can see, they do not depend by the field content. What does it mean? It means that A0 and A1 actually shift. sheet like a gauge connection with sheet with a D lambda when you do a gauge transformation. And these are exactly indeed the gauge parameter for which this object is a connection. This is a connection for translation, the leading order, and A1 is a connection actually for the GL2R. Okay, so this is everything organized in a very nice way. Of course, the metric is adapted, so we find what we expect. But let it go even more classical. And let's now introduce Einstein gravity as the defining theory and compute the charges associated to a diffeomorphism. Let me furthermore clearly specialize to k equal 2 because we're interested in corners now. And we will compute Noether charges, hard Noether charges. It is a question whether these are the right charges to compute, but this question will be addressed later on in this talk. Now, if we compute with respect to the trivial embedding, so here I should stress that we are computing them with respect to phi zero star, we pull back the Noether charge to the corner, and we use the hard definition star dg of C, the vector field. It is important that in these charges we insert the full diffm vector field expanding the powers of U and not the maximal embedded algebra. We want to obtain it. We don't want to impose it to begin with. These are going to be the only survive charges. And if we do this computation, we notice two things. The first thing is that we have to be take care of the embedding. This is important. And as I just said, we should really insert an arbitrary diffeomorphism. So we insert it and we compute, and the final result is this one over here, in which you notice that very nicely this charge is organized with respect to the maximal embedded algebra, and there is nothing more generated by the diffeomorphisms. All the local symmetries that give rise to non-vanishing Noether charges are the one of the maximal embedded algebra and nothing more. This is a very important cross-verification of the importance of this algebra, which is, again, a universal feature that in this classical theory is indeed the thing that turns on to give rise to the Noether charges. This result is in agreement with works that has been done previously, and actually soon after our paper in April, there have been another paper by Laurent and collaborators in which they obtain exactly the same algebra. And let me comment about what they are, the different quantities. The different quantities that couple to the generators are these momenta that depend by the field content of the theory, with the momentum for translation, for diffs, and for GL. Notice, however, that if we take the trace of this, this is zero by construction, which means that the GL2 singlet, which is the guy here proportional to the trace, decoupled. And that's why we obtain the first SL2R R2 rather than GL2R, the singlet GL2 singlet decoupled dynamically from the algebra. Okay, the next question that we ask ourselves is, can we compute an algebra? Can we compute the algebra of these charges? And again, I will not introduce a field space now. I want just to think about it as a computation, intrinsic computation without a field space. And later on, I will find a field space that accommodates this result. And here comes a very important understanding of the embeddings and what the embeddings are doing. The reason why I insisted on not taking only the trivial embedding is because when we compute the charges variation, we are tempted to pass the variation through the embedding, but this actually for certain transformations is wrong. It's wrong because there are certain transformations that would actually physically change the embedding itself. So we cannot just pass it through. And this transformation has been already understood to do this effect previously and are indeed the translations. The translations, you can think of them as taking the position of the embedded space and move it. Okay, and indeed one should be careful with that, and symbolically one should write something of this form in which we also consider the variation of the pullback itself. The variation of the pullback can be computed. This is what turns out to be. And the simple way to understand this result is a sort of active versus passive interpretation of what these symmetries, transformations are doing to the embedding. We can either vary the embedding itself computed on the old charges or pull back with the old embedding on the transformed charges, where now this eta vector field just shifted the coordinates. And this really is an active interpretation on the bedding versus passive interpretation on the coordinate system for the charges evaluation. Now, with all these at our disposal, we can go back and compute the variation of the charges. And we introduce for the moment a bracket notation of this form. These brackets are not canonical whatsoever. There's no phase space to begin with here so far. So we just introduce a bracket notation. And if we define the smeared charges, namely integrated on S charges for our maximal embedded algebra, the structure of this bracket is exactly a faithful representation of the vector fields algebra. Okay, so there are two important things here is that this is an exact result derived again without covariant phase space assumptions, except that the notor charges we have used are the notor charges hard. And the second important realization that people use with the local symmetries computation will certainly notice is that there are no central exceptions. So this algebra is faithful. It represents faithfully the vector fields algebra. Okay, so let me give a little recap of where we are in our discussion. This was mainly based on our paper in April. And the first important thing we have done is that we have derived this universal algebra that we call maximal embedded algebra at the level of the vector fields. This has been done in a completely independent, universal way, independent from matrix construction. Later, we went down to some more down-to-earth analysis, and we introduced notor charges. We compute the charges, and we show that I actually coupled together nicely this maximal embedded algebra. And we computed, being careful on the variation of the embedding, the charge algebra. We introduce embedded notation, and this charge algebra represents faithfully this algebra here, with, again, the little important catch with the GL2 singlet. The next question we asked ourselves is, OK, very good. Is there a classical phase space for this? Do we have a well-defined variational principle, a symplectic to form, all these classical covariant phase space machinery such that these charges are the right charges and this bracket are the right bracket? And that will be very clear in the moment of what I mean with that. All right, I think it's a good place if someone has some questions. You, Alessia, were saying that they are supposed to raise their hands, but I don't see hands. So maybe I can
continue.
Yes,
there are no raised
hands. Okay.
Oh, there is one by Charlie.
Perfect. Hello.
Hey, I was just wondering how you're thinking about this decoupling of the from basically going from GL to SL. Are you going to think about that as like a gauge symmetry, or are you just going to not worry about it for now? Or I was just wondering if you could say a little more about this dropping from GL to
pleasure.
SL.
With pleasure. Absolutely. Thanks for asking. The way I think about this is, first of all, let me point out one thing. There are works by Antonin Speranza in which it is shown that also for higher derivative theories, gravitational theories, this singlet decouples, which means that somehow it's always pure gauge in this theory of gravity. So I think of it as becoming pure gauge. I think of it as becoming the part of the trivial bulk diffeomorphism that, as I will explain later on, I should quotient out when I define the physical symmetries. Yes, that's what I think about it. And it happens always because of this contraction with epsilon, which is a natural object that you define in the two-dimensional normal plane. There is always this epsilon AB, probably root gamma or root H, where H is the metric, to make it invariant. And this object always will mix the indices such that the trace part decouples. That's what we have observed.
And just a quick follow-up. I was wondering, so you started off with Einstein gravity, but in some sense, it feels like you're kind of getting like a Weyl gravity type situation because the overall scale is decoupling. Is that a good way to think about it? What's the difference between starting with Einstein or Weyl gravity with this decoupling?
And, This is the thing. I think what I was discussing with Anthony, I think that this happens in viral gravity and in Einstein gravity, the decoupling. Mm-hmm. So it's independent by that. So I thought for a while it was associated to some sort of, I thought that when I would put some conformal theory, it would couple to the GL2 physically. But this is not what happens, apparently. So I had a very similar intuition, I would say, than your question, but it turns out to be not the case, actually.
Interesting. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello,
there's
I see another
question.
Hand.
Yes, Florian.
Yeah. I was just wondering, so you're doing an expansion, and so at the beginning, and so I was wondering whether there was some, so I guess you have a parameter, and I was wondering if this parameter had some kind of physical meaning and so on. And I guess, assume if you have the DFOs, I guess this parameter is not changing under the DFOs as well. So I was just I think when you do an expansion, for me, usually you have something small that characterizes this expansion.
Good. Let me go a bit back. If I find a slide in which I give you dynamics, this is the slide. So we have an expansion in one parameter, that's U, the coordinate U itself. It has a dimension. So as you are saying, there is, you can think of it as a parameter that I'm expanding small, but I'm not keeping it fixed. I'm actually under a the diffeomorphisms, I'm moving it. And this is actually this effect that you see here in magenta. So there is an expansion, there is a parameter, but I'm not thinking of that as something rigid that I put outside the system. And indeed, it's crucial in the analysis of embeddings that this parameter itself will change under diffeomorphisms, but it's changing in a controlled way.
Okay. And is there a notion of small then? Or there is no notion of small, I guess, because it's kind of changing. I mean,
Well, there is a notion of small because the changes I'm talking about are always happening at the level of the algebra, so they're always infinitesimal. So there is a notion of I say what is small, and then I'm infinitesimally close to the small. But indeed, if you go to the group version, it's like exponentiating all this construction here, and then you will lose that notion.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other raised hands, so I will go quickly to the point in which I was. And I'm sure there are going to be some raised hands later on, because there is an interesting classical phase space discussion that will arise with some twist, some recent twist. But let me, in the spirit of keeping all of you in the discussion, let me try to introduce a bit the classical phase space. I think it's something that sometimes we keep aside, so it's good to give a notion, a defined notion of symplectic manifold. And I will do it in a very simple context, and then I will tell you why gravity is not that simple after all. Okay, so let me introduce it in a nutshell very quickly. I can think of a symplectic manifold as a space gamma, and the idea is that when I think of the configuration space or the field space as a space itself, then I can think of its variation of varying configuration as just an exterior derivative, geometrically an exterior derivative. So that's the one of the main utilities. And I will refer to this space gamma as a symplectic manifold. And I think of defining a metric on this space gamma, which is a symplectic two-form. Okay, it is a two-form that furthermore has a defining property, which is the fact that it is closed. Now, in this simple construction that I'm giving here to give you a flavor of symplectic manifolds, I'm assuming trivial topologies for gamma, then being closed means that it is delta of something. Delta for the phase space stays to as D for the Deram cohomology on the manifold. So it's exactly the same construction. And another property in simple classical phase spaces that I will require is that omega is non-degenerate. What does it mean is that if I introduce a vector field on the space, I will call it V sub xi for reasons that will be clear later on. I contract, I is the field space contraction with omega V, and this is zero if and only if V itself is zero. So omega itself is not degenerate, it doesn't have zero modes. Okay, as we will see, we will later on for gravity, things are trickier, but for the moment, I want just to give you a basic introduction. Okay, then a symplectomorphism is simply a symmetry that actually creates an isometry for this metric omega. An isometry in phase space. So I define the Lie derivative in space just using Cartan magic formula. We're talking about forms. And I act with the Lie derivative of this Hamiltonian vector field to omega, symplectic vector field, sorry. And I require that it is zero. Now, if I use the defining property that I just showed, that delta omega itself is zero by construction, it means that when I act with the Lie derivative, I obtain delta of IV omega being zero, and delta of IV omega is zero if and only if, assuming trivial topology, IV omega itself is delta of something. This is now the crucial equation in symplectic manifolds. Is called sometimes integrability equation, and it's just telling you that for each vector field on this symplectic manifold, I can introduce a function on it. Why this is a function? Because this is a two-form omega. I contract it once, so I get a one-form, and this one-form is exact, it's delta of something. So this f sitting there is a function on phase space. For instance, a Lagrangian would be a function of phase space. This function is, if this equation is true, this function itself is associated to a symplectomorphism, so it is a generator of canonical transformations. Okay, given this, I can further introduce brackets for them, these functions themselves. These brackets are called Poisson brackets. And what happens is that if both xi and eta are symplectomorphism, these brackets are defined simply to be the Lie derivative with respect to eta of the function f. And by construction, since f itself is a zero form, so the contraction gives zero, I obtain IV delta f. But delta f is a generator of canonical transformation. And so I obtain immediately that is IV IV omega. Okay, two properties are clear from this derivation, and actually two properties holds only if this derivation is correct, so only if they are canonical transformations. The first one is that this bracket is Q, because I is Q. When I write it in this way, this is evident. And the second, which is a more complicated thing to show, is that it satisfies Jacobi. So if I take a third function and I cyclically permute these brackets, it gives me zero. Okay, so it's very important that we're talking about symplectomorphism, that we're talking about isometries. And then we can introduce these Poisson brackets, which are canonical brackets. Another important result is that, and I will not tell you for the moment what this bracket is, I will tell it for you later on, but is that if I take I of the bracket of these two Bs, it becomes delta of this Poisson bracket. Why this is important? It is important because if I have a notion of this bracket, then the Poisson bracket themselves define a representation of this bracket via this equation, which is actually projective. It's projective because if to the Poisson bracket I add something, let me call it kappa, such that delta kappa is zero, I obtain the same equation over here. So it's a representation modulo three, it's modulo central extensions. So quantities that are not varying in the phase space. Okay, and all these properties derive from the fact that they are symplectomorphism, the objects I'm talking about. So let me see a very simple equation example, just to build that familiarity with it. Let's just consider classical mechanics, and there is a simple set of coordinates we can use, which are called the Darboux coordinates, and they're the one for which the symplectic to form just is delta p delta q, where q are the configuration variables and p the associative momentum. Then the closure implies that omega is delta A, and A in Darboux coordinate is just P delta Q. Then all the quantities I introduced before become very clear, and we're very familiar with from analytical mechanics. If I introduce a symplectomorphism parameterizing these coordinates locally, it's just d by dq, d by dp with some components. And if I solve for the integrability, which is this equation here, then I get a condition for the components P and Q. And the condition is that essentially Q is delta F delta P, and P is minus delta F delta Q. And this vector field, you might recognize it to be the vector field that preserves the Hamilton-Jacobi equations of motion for the classical system. Furthermore, I can compute the bracket, supposing both of them to be symplectomorphism, and I get this expression here, which is also familiar from classical mechanics, and it is the expression actually that generates the Hamilton-Jacobi equations of motion if one of the two functions is the Hamiltonian of the system. Okay, so everything I've derived before has a very clear meaning in classical mechanics, and now we want to make a step ahead and try to see what happens in gravity. What's happened in gravity? Is there something wrong? Yes, there is something wrong with this simple construction. And what is wrong in gravity are mainly two things. The first one is that there are zero modes. It's not true that omega is non-degenerate. And indeed, we refer to it as a pre-symplectic two form rather than a symplectic one. But this is a problem that, although is very hard in concrete example to treat, sort of standard solution, which is to identify the zero mode and realize that the non-zero modes are an ideal, and therefore I can quotient the zero modes out, okay? And this is, for instance, something that relates to the question before about the GL2 versus SL2. In that theory, the singlet in GL2 is a zero mode, and then I should quotient it out, okay? The second problem, which is actually more complicated, is that naively, in a sense, I will explain why naively, for me, for a different morphism, actually, we don't have integrability. So a diffeomorphism in general, the Hamiltonian vector field associated to it is not a symplectomorphism. It's not an isometry of the two form. And this is a big problem because everything we just said about the Poisson brackets, about generating and preserving some equations of motion does not apply for objects that are not symplectomorphism. There is a long debate in the literature about this. And our solution, the one I will propose now, is actually to be very careful with the embeddings and how the embeddings behave. And this is actually something that has already been discussed by Will and Lorane in their 2016 paper with a different spirit, but essentially with some basic interpretation that are similar to ours. Our outcome will be different. Now, let me just review quickly in 2 minutes what happens if one would naively disregard the embeddings to begin with. So if you disregard the embeddings to begin with, then what happens is that every time you have a delta, you pass it through for every object that you are integrating over. And if you do that, you create the typical construction, which is that when you vary the action, you create the equations of motion plus the so-called presymplectic potential, one form, in phase space. And if you contrast with the diffeomorphism, this is zero by construction, the action is diff-invariant. And what you create is two quantities that on shell, this hat means on shell, are related. And this is how one introduced the so-called weakly vanishing, because it's vanishing on your shell, not their current. Then, as a byproduct of another second theorem, one can show that dj is zero, which means that j is d of q, where q now is what we call a charge, because q now is a codimension 2. And one would proceed again, disregarding embeddings, just by defining integrated symplectic two form from delta theta. And if you compute the contraction, this is the equation that will guarantee for you integrability, and it's not integrable because of this very important term. This very important term is called sometimes Hamiltonian flux, and there are various reasons to possibilities and solutions in the literature. One is to impose boundary conditions, the other one is to restrict the observers that you are considering to compute charges. And in general, though, when you have a construction like this, you cannot trust your Poisson bracket. And indeed, there are proposals for modifications of the bracket. Our proposal, though, goes back to the question I asked in the previous part of the talk, is to be careful with embeddings. That's what we use to derive this, our notion of brackets we introduce. And indeed, the idea is to interpret the embedding as dynamical object in the phase space. This comes about because if you're considering delta eta of phi star to be not zero, as we did before, you can think of it as the result of doing two things, of considering phi star, of taking an arbitrary variation, so not being zero in phase space, and then of contracting it with something. Okay, and indeed, one thing of thinking of delta eta, as we saw before in the passive interpretation, is of changing coordinates themselves. This happens through this enhancement of the field space. So this construction, which is the usual one, where this L here is actually the space-timely derivative, is supplemented now by another field, which is a one-form in phase space, such that when contracted with the vector field, gives the vector field itself evaluated on the embedded surface. Okay. And then if one do that by construction, the result that we have established before, this is exactly the result we have established before, because when you contract it with IV eta, you obtain this result I show you, is just phi star of the Lie derivative with respect to this chi. Then when we vary the action, we should be careful, because in acting with delta, once we act on the Lagrangian itself, and the other actually we act on the embedding, producing this term. This suggests the introduction of a new symplectic potential, which is different from the one we would introduce before with the non-enhanced phase space, which keeps into account both contribution from theta, the usual one, and this extra contribution coming from the embedding that themselves vary and produce this term. Then, by computing what happens to the symplectic to form, we obtain this result, which might be not simple to read, but however, one thing that once obtained, once contracted in, is integrability. Integrability for all vector fields, eta here, I didn't have to specify which vector fields is integrable and which not, and for all boundary conditions, because I haven't imposed any to begin with. And the idea is that the Hamiltonian flux has been taken care of by the variation of the embedding itself. Okay, and the noter charge that we use here, which is not trivial, I'm not showing it for you, but can be shown exactly, is the hard noter charge. It's the noter charge defined from the very beginning without any modification, without any ambiguity used, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so this result is a very appealing result, in my opinion, that we are now trying to explore. Then, by construction, essentially, since they are integrable for all diffeomorphism, the Poisson bracket are canonical. And indeed, once we take double contractions, we just obtain the Poisson bracket here. But this charge is what, by brute force computation before, we computed, and we defined for it a notion of bracket. This notion of bracket that we defined before. Okay, then what we have just shown here actually is that the final important result is that our brackets that we introduced before without having a phase space associated are actually the Poisson canonical bracket of this extended phase space I've just introduced by taking care of the embeddings. This is our crucial result. Actually, I would like to stress two things. The first one is that we could have had central charges, but it's just the fact that we didn't. These Poisson brackets are still projected on the phase space. And the second important result is that I didn't impose an external condition on my vector fields and on my boundary conditions. Okay? Introducing external condition, we will reduce and constrain our system as usual, but this integrability notion is there from the beginning, which is actually different because our phase space is different from what has been done before. All right. Do I still have 5 minutes, Alessia, perhaps to go through some future perspective?
Yes, you can have no more than 5 minutes.
No more than 5. Okay, excellent. I will take only 5. All right, so let me recap very quickly then. What we have done in the first part of the talk was to derive this maximal embedded algebra that we expect to be a universal building block for quantum observables. We then introduce a field space in which the non-vanishing noter charges are just the one given by the maximal embedded algebra, generated by the maximal embedded algebra vector fields. And this has been obtained without introducing boundary conditions, without playing with ambiguities, and without a necessary gauge fixing on the metric itself. And our outcome was a charge algebra canonically generated by the Poisson bracket, which is a faithful representation of the maximal embedded algebra. Okay, so I distinguish now my future, the future perspectives in 3, the near future, middle future, and far future. I go in order from something that I expect to achieve quickly in the forthcoming months to something that will take me more time. In the near future, I definitely would like to understand more the embeddings and what happened to the physical fluxes. Actually, I didn't discuss it because I didn't have time, but the charges themselves in space-time are not necessary. necessarily conserved. They are conserved in field space. They are integrable in field space, but not in space-time. So I would like to understand this interplay between fluxes in phase space and fluxes in space-time itself. Another thing that we're working on now is applying all these results to Chern-Simons or gauge theories in general, because this has nothing necessarily to do with gravity per se. I have used in the first part of the talk a finite distance corner. I would like to apply an asymptotic corner discussion. And importantly, we are trying to understand whether the proposal by Hawking, Perry, and Strominger in 15 and 16 could arise from our enhanced phase space, and by varying carefully the embedding when apply these to the black hole itself. And finally, something I was telling you before, we are working on some links with the W1 plus infinity algebra and the celestial proposal. In the not so near future, we would like to take more seriously the quantum perspective of the beginning of the talk, and therefore believe this maximal embedded algebra without introducing some dynamics, classical dynamics. And to do so, we will need a way to classify and understanding representations of this algebra. This is, however, complicated because it is a semidirect product, but there are some tools. For instance, the quadjoint orbit method derived by Kirillov is a tool to understand representations without necessarily going to phase space. And we hope to answer some questions about the universality of this algebra. Are there universal isotopy groups? Can we understand more really quantum phenomena rather than just restrict to some classical analysis? And finally, we believe that we should study better the geometric structure underlying this corner, in the corner proposal idea, inspired by holographic setups like ADSFT. There should be a better understanding in this logic of the CFT side, which in this case is this corner itself and this geometric structure, the corner. And then in the far future, hopefully we will understand, as you see, this maximal embedded algebra seems to give all the informations that the classical space-time will need to be reconstructed. So we hope to see the space-time emerging naturally, relating somehow to the question I had before about the parameter expansion. There might be some sort of long wave approximation so that the classical space-time will arise. This can give this maximum embedded algebra can give quantum gravity prediction. I'm exploring some questions in entanglement entropy. This algebra is bigger than the algebra we've seen already, and the algebras we've seen already contains BMS algebra that gave rise to memory effects. So maybe this bigger algebra will give rise to some other memory effects to be understood. And even farther, I hope to understand better corners as microscopic constituent of a quantum gravity theory. And so I would have to understand how to link them to fusion to corner structure and make them scatter together, which is essentially what I repeat over here. And I think I must stop now, so I stop. Thank you very much for the attention.
Thanks for Luca for the very nice talk. Okay, are there questions?
There was something in the chat, probably.
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't. No, sorry. It was your message. Sorry.
Oh, yes. So it was to Barfa. So I don't see questions at the moment. So let me start. So first, you. Well, I have several questions. Maybe the one of the most basic questions, as I'm not an expert on the topic, is what makes a corner so special. So at the beginning, you have shown the starting point with this manifold and the manifold S that has d minus k dimension, and you pick the k equal to 2 case. So why specifically you take that, and why the other cases for the different values of k can be as interesting?
Excellent. Thank you very much, actually. You give me the opportunity to go through that concept again, which is very important. K equal 2 is very special, and the corners are codimension 2. So corners are very special. And the reason why they're special is because they are actually the geometric objects on which local symmetry charges have support on. So if you take a global symmetry and you sort of solve Noether force theorem, you would just get a current, a conserved current, and the charge associated to it, which is on a hypersurface. If you reproduce the same computation for local symmetries, it turns out in Noether second theorem that the charges are actually associated to surface. So they're called surface charges. And the reason you can see it over here, if this L is a top form, because it's a Lagrangian, and you can see that this J here has already had a contraction with L, then you take D of this quantity, and then you get down, you boil down to Q. The Q that I have here, which is the charge I defined, sorry, let me go back to it, which is the charge I have defined, oops, it's even before, just a second. No, it's not here, it's later. Well, let me just write it down. It's the charge that I've defined as star dg psi. Okay, if you see what is the dimensionality of this object, you're taking the metric to lower a vector, so that gives you one form. Then you're taking d of it, that gives you two form, and then you're taking Dodge dual. So that gives you a d minus two form, which is already made to be integrated over a codimension to surface, which is the corner. And these are the basic constituents. The Noether charges are the basic constituents. So that's why K equal 2 is very special when you want to talk about classical charges. Then, you know, in general, that's the reason why we kept K arbitrary. You may expect some maybe higher form symmetry to play a certain game or some other quantities that we're still trying to study and are maybe relevant, in which you may need other codimensionality.
Okay, great. Thanks for the detailed explanation. Are there more questions?
Yeah, hi Luca. Thanks for
the message. Hi, Daniele.
I wanted to ask, since you mentioned application to asymptotic infinity, and in that case you need to introduce field dependence in the vector fields and anomalies to renormalize. So how does your construction of this extended conifer space goes through if you introduce anomalies and field dependence?
Okay, very good. So thank you for the question, actually. It's a bit technical, but not so much, because it's a standard thing that one needs to understand. So I haven't worked it out, but I'm convinced, and this is something I'm exploring, that for the field dependencies in the vector fields themselves, I think it will just go through by accordingly modify everything. Okay, this is what I expect. Now, maybe it's not that simple because there is an embedding in between. I know also that Laurent, which I just saw in the camera, appeared, has published a paper recently in which goes through some very similar logic also with vector field dependencies. Sorry, with field dependencies in the vector fields. So I believe it will go through. Concerning anomalies, this is actually something that I'm a bit perplexed, because I think there must be a way in which you can define asymptotically what's going on without restricting. So what happens is that, for instance, if you take the paper by Anthony in which he studies null hypersurfaces and is putting some condition of the vector field that that define the null structure, and then he can show that to this condition, from this condition, anomaly arises. This, what we did here is without that condition, right? So I'm sure that I will be able to see it once I perhaps go back to some simpler construction in which I impose by hand some conditions. But I would say that as long as I don't impose a particular boundary condition to some geometric structure that I hold fixed, I do not generate an anomalous transformation in my phase space.
Yeah, yeah, but usually to renormal, when you go to infinity, you need to renormalize, and that is usually done by introducing some, I mean, breaking the covariance, right? So that's why I would expect that anomalies could play an important role.
I agree with you. Eventually, we will need to go down to that. But I wanted just to point out, because I don't know if that was clear, that I don't expect that problem to arise in general. But then, yes, specifically when I want to study about how to renormalize, I will have to face that problem. That's maybe actually, I was discussing recently in Brussels, that's maybe actually the reason why there could be central extensions appearing once I do that. Because one puzzle that I had for a while was why I don't have central extensions for this maximal embedded realization. And it might be related to the fact that I'm not imposing some boundary conditions. And once I sit down and try to do that, that could arise because I'm reducing the field space by hand.
Yeah, right. I mean, definitely, I mean, that would enter the Hamiltonian flux, right? Both the field dependence and the anomalies. So whether you can get rid of those terms as well or not, or interpret them as central charges, that's is going to be important, right? In
absolutely. Business. Absolutely, absolutely. But the second part has not been done assuming a finite distance corner. But it is true that the algebra that I found without central extension has been obtained with this finite distance expansion that actually of this metric here. So it's true that I don't know what happens when I will apply that to the infinite distance one. On the other hand, I know that if I don't impose conditions, at least I observe from the theoretical phase space construction, you know, independent by the situation at hand, that I can define varying the embedding integrable phase space.
Next, there is a question by Charlie.
Hi, thanks for the very interesting talk. Could you go to your very last slide again?
Yes, I will take a while because I'm moving me with my hand, but...
No worries. Basically, I was just trying to think more about what you said about, if I am remembering correctly, like scattering corners or something like that.
Yes, absolutely.
I was just wondering, with these, if you have any ideas on this yet, like what time coordinate, so to speak, are you scattering with respect to? How are you thinking about scattering these things? Because there's not really a natural time coordinate anymore, is there?
Absolutely, I agree with you. But there is no natural, I mean, the time coordinate is exiled to the normal direction. So intrinsically, right, there are no time coordinates. I agree with you.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I was thinking more of in this sense. So if I'm able to formulate a geometric understanding of corners intrinsically without the normal directions and so as some sort of geometric structure, then it is a question of gluing together these geometric structures. And I expect that and this is actually related to what there are some papers, recent paper by Lorani, with Daniele, in which they are doing that. I expect that the rules of the game will tell me which temporal evolutions, if we boil down to some classical interpretation, are allowed and which are not. And this is similar to what happens when I shouldn't say similar, but in my mind, at least philosophically, it resembles some sort of bootstrapping technique for the way you can glue together things. You just know the algebra, which is a kinematic feature, and by know what kinematics are allowed, you sort of gather intuition of what eventually the dynamics will be.
Sorry, I think I'm confusing myself a little. What do you mean exactly by, like, gluing together the corners? Is that forming just a bigger space-time, or am I taking that idea too literally, maybe?
No, you're not taking it too literally. I mean, eventually, I would like to say that by gluing together corners, I can sort of see a space-time emerging or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a more simple idea of gluing together. The gluing together would be like, for instance, if I able to put a corner on as a celestial sphere configuration of Scry minus and the corner of celestial sphere configuration of Scry plus,
right?
Just by knowing the way the algebra representation behave and the way I can transform a certain field, I get a set of rules, right, for what could happen on Scry plus.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not thinking of this gluing as something that necessarily appears locally. It's a gluing at the level of the algebra, right?
Right. Yeah, that's okay. But still there's like, I think I just need to think more about what the time coordinate would be. Thank you.
Oh, well, I mean, it's an important discussion because in the picture we were just saying now, in which I think like here having a corner and here having a corner and having some sort of, you know, features here and telling the way they are glued together. Indeed, one should be careful how I'm getting there, right? So, yes, the way you should. But to some extent, this double expansion in the normal directions makes the radial direction and the, if you want, scry now time direction on more similar footing. And this is the spirit in which it's really codimension two. I expect classical interpretation of phase space to be sort of codimension one, because you have to pick up a sort of hypersurface on which determines some sort of conservations, because you have to take D of the charge. That's is a codimension one, but probably at the level of algebras and more classical independent feature, I can really think of a codimension two intrinsically without having to specify a hypersurface. But okay, I mean, this was in a galaxy far, far away, so I don't know if this is where you are with your rotating black hole behind you, but I'm definitely not there yet.
Are there more questions or comments? Nosrat?
Thank you for your nice talk. And
thank you.
Hey, my question is not so relevant to your talk, but is there any possibility for nonlinear Poisson brackets in the classical coordinates that you have there, in the Poisson bracket that you use?
You scattered a bit with the mic. Did you ask non-linear Poisson brackets? So are you asking if you have
a possibility for non-linear Poisson bracket in there in your classical coordinates? Then you have a Poisson bracket.
I mean, okay, but. So first, there is actually a sense in which, and this is something actually that has been worked out by Céline, Shaheen, Daniel Grumiller at a certain point, there is a sense in which you are allowed to perform any kind of redefinition of your parameters that could create some sort of nonlinearity at the level of the bracket. So I don't know clearly. I'm not sure I can give you a definite answer, but I don't know if your question is related to there has been a question by Teitelbaum a long time ago in which there are examples in which they've shown that by redefining the charges of the system, you can actually even change the linear algebra. So I don't know if this is related to that, your question, but
because the linear Poisson bracket can be related to double associative relativity theories in some.
It can be related to, sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Double associative relativity theories, double special relativity, SR theory, double special relativity sometimes. And I'm thinking about, is it possible to remove the linearity in your theory? Because in some approach to SR, you can remove the linearity in Poisson bracket and you can translate the whole theory to the linear one. But if you can have some linear Poisson bracket, then you can have some maybe interesting things in algebra and in geometry. I don't know exactly, but
no, I see. And okay, yeah,
connection between
sorry,
what interrupting between SR and the definition of the parameters and transformations.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I wouldn't say that linearity of the brackets is necessarily a requirement in these constructions. I wouldn't say that. I would say that there was recently I should perhaps have mentioned it, part of this introduction to the classical phase space I did at the beginning of the second part of the talk was inspired by a very nice lecture notes that Marc Henno gave in Vienna last year. Actually, this year, we're still in 2021, in which he discussed also non-linearity. I can point that out to you if you want for further readings, but I'm not sure I have a complete understanding of it yet.
Maybe I can ask by the email.
Right, with pleasure.
Thank
sure.
You. Thank you.
Thank you.
More questions? So I don't see any. Let's close the discussion and let's thank Luca again for the nice talk and the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Luca. Bye.
Bye.
Last thank seminar you, for this year. See you all next year and enjoy your vacation. Bye.